Welcome to Biz Rocket Radio with Stone Payton and John Baker. John Baker is a certified financial planner with a Master's of Science in Personal Financial Planning. Certified Financial Planner Board of Standards, Inc. owns the certification mark CFP, Certified Financial Planner, TM and CFP, and in the U.S., which it awards to individuals who successfully complete the CFP Board's initial and ongoing certification requirements. John Baker offers financial planning and securities through Woodbury Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor and broker dealer, member FINRA SIPC, located at 1050 Crown Point Parkway, Suite 1675, Atlanta, Georgia 30338. This program is for information purposes only and should not be considered a solicitation of or offer to buy or offer to sell securities or investment advisory services. Information in this program regarding market or other financial information is obtained from sources which are believed to be reliable. We do not warrant or guarantee the timeliness or accuracy of this information. When considering any registered security products, seek a prospectus carefully before you invest. Make sure you consult your financial professional regarding any specific situation. And now, get ready for Biz Rocket Radio. Here's Stone Payton and John Baker.
Good morning and welcome to Biz Rocket Radio. This is John Baker and we come to you on this April 11th, 2012, on this gorgeous day here in Atlanta. Once again, we got a nice early spring and not good news for some of the people on the show today because the rain has not been coming quite as aggressively as it was earlier this year, but we'll get into that. Biz Rocket Radio is an opportunity for us to chat with executives and business owners here in the Atlanta area, learn from their experiences, some of the challenges that they've had, as well as their successes. And today we've got a panel that I'm excited to talk to because it's about alternative energy sources and saving resources that we have here and on this great earth, and I've actually had Bob Drew, who's one of our guests on our show, about 4 or 5 months ago, and he's come on again, and we've also got Tim Uzer. Tim?
Uzar.
Uzar. I'm killing your names here. Sorry about that. And then Steve, and I'm not even going to try the last.
Shirello.
There you go, Shirello.
Yeah. Right. I have the easy name.
I know. Bob Drew. I got that one. Right. So, Bob, welcome back.
Thank you. It's great to be back here again. I remember the last time I was here, it was raining buckets.
It was.
As I drove up, and there was traffic, and it was great for rainwater collection. But today, it's great for solar.
That's right.
Now's when you're using all that water you collected a month ago, right?
Exactly.
That's right. So, Bob, maybe you could tell us a little bit about EcoV and your company.
Yeah, EcoV Environmental started in late 2008. I had worked in corporate America for many, many years doing engineering, M&A, a lot of different things, and just felt the need to do something that I really, really felt passion for. And that happened to be water. And what EcoV does is we deal in water management. We collect rainwater. We design systems for rainwater collection for residences, for commercial clients, for institutional clients to use that water as a water supply for many different things, be it irrigation, cooling tower makeup, toilet flushing, laundry, even drinking water sources. We've done a number of those. And the benefits of rainwater collection, which we'll get into, are not just water supply, building your own reservoir, but on the other side, preventing stormwater runoff, flooding, erosion, and those sorts of things. And that's the environmental benefit or the green benefit, if you may.
All right. Perfect. Our second guest is Tim. Tim is with Ecomec. So, Tim, tell us a little bit about Ecomec.
Ecomec is, we kind of designed it as a one-stop shop for green, how to make your house a well-oiled machine by working with people like Inman Solar and Bob Drew. We can kind of be a one-stop shop for green technologies, mainly focusing on geothermal systems, also spray foam insulation, rainwater collection, solar water heating, solar panels.
All right. And how long have you been running the company?
We started the company in 2009, but I've actually been doing these technologies since about 2007.
All right. Good. So the third person on our panel, Steve with Inman Solar, and you are the one of the partners with Inman Solar, I believe.
Yeah, that's correct. Inman Solar, as the name implies, does solar systems. We strictly focus on photovoltaic. So although there are some other solar technologies out there, we focus on PV. So generating electricity from the sun's energy. We do mainly commercial projects. We do residential as well, but we really position it as an investment, and as such, the investment generally works better for private business owners mainly, but also anyone who owns a building and has a roof that's sitting there costing them money. We can help them turn that into a profit center.
So let's kind of throw out the first question of the panel here, and that has to do with. Why you guys started into this area of the business and why you decided that this, whether it was rainwater or solar or spray insulation or whatever the case may be, why did you see that as something that you wanted to get into?
In my case, with regard to water, I saw the opportunity here in Metro Atlanta where it was 2007. We had a drought. It was still raining a fair amount. We had about 32 inches of rain that year, but people were very concerned about water supply. And I saw the opportunity to provide not a new idea, but a new idea that has new technology. And that's what we did. Left the firm I was with, started the business, and it's been great ever since. We've been growing even through the financial downturn and the economy the way it is. Things are really picking up now.
So and Bob, when you first got into it, is it something that you got into more as a passion or more because you saw the business opportunity?
It was 50-50. It was really both, and that was something I was looking for as a business I wanted to get into, something I had a strong passion for and something where I saw a big opportunity, at least long term.
Okay. Tim, how about you?
Well, my story goes back to 95. I began in the commercial mechanical contracting industry. 2006, decided to throw in that towel and try building some custom homes. Built some high-end custom homes using a lot of these green technologies, geothermal, rainwater collection, solar panels, and solar hot water heating. 2009, decided to take kind of the best of both worlds and just focus on these green technologies for customers and builders alike.
And, living in Roswell, there's a small little community right off the kind of the main drag there in Roswell. They tried to put this small little green almost neighborhood. They were going to put five or six houses up, and I think one got up, and then they kind of stopped. Has that picked back up again? Are builders starting to look at building houses that are from the ground floor up green?
Thankfully, yes. It's finally starting to take hold, and I would say as of 3 months ago.
So that recent?
It's slow to come on. It's hard. It's like turning the Titanic around. It's just hard changing people's mentality of, well, we've always done it this way. Why try something new? But I think the customers are beginning to drive that change.
And when you're looking at something that you're building from the ground floor up versus something that you're kind of trying to change from, electric or what have you to all these other alternatives, how difficult is that getting a house that's not really designed to take on that type of technology completely renovated?
Some aspects, it's very simple. Other aspects, it's almost impossible. For example, a house that's currently built, it's just about impossible to spray foam the walls of the house at this point. Whereas you can retrofit the roof line with spray foam pretty easy.
Right.
Geothermal installation is pretty easy. You do have to pretty much re-landscape the yard after you're done. That's really the only drawback to that. But actually, on the geothermal side, 50% of our business is in the retrofit and 50% is in the new construction. So there's really not a drawback to putting geothermal in an existing house.
And what is geothermal?
Geothermal is super, super high efficiency heating and cooling system. Code minimum is a 13 SEER.
What does that mean if I don't know what a SEER is?
Sure. SEER stands for Seasonal Energy Efficiency Ratio. For every 1 unit of energy you purchase from the power company, you get 13 units of energy in output. High efficiency heating and cooling system might be around 16 to 18 SEER.
Mm-hmm.
A geothermal heating and cooling system is around 35 to 40
wow.
SEER. It's, you know, almost 3.5 times more efficient. So if you look at it from a mathematical standpoint, for every 1 unit of energy, you get 35 to 40 units of energy in output versus 13. So it's
and that's something retrofitting isn't as hard to do, or it's a little harder, but not impossible.
It's slightly harder only because you have to re-landscape the yard back. We've been fortunate that we can put them in pine straw areas sometimes, and it's not very expensive to re-pine straw something after you've done the work.
Especially in Georgia.
That's right. So, yeah.
All right. So that's kind of resetting things up. Are you doing much work on kind of brand new homes? I know it's starting to pick up again, but do they call you to come do some of that work for them?
That's 50% of our business.
Okay.
Yeah. A lot of builders just call us directly. We've got a good relationship with a lot of builders. A lot of builders are getting requests from their clients. I want you to build a house, but I want geothermal. I want spray foam. That's becoming more and more mainstream. Like I said, actually, it's really a very recent thing that we're seeing. But the builders are kind of not resisting anymore, and they're playing into this whole energy efficiency movement.
I got to tell you, we just did an addition on our house, and we built a garage, and then over the garage we put a bedroom, and we decided to set the bedroom up as our bedroom. It was supposed to be the kids, and we were like, who cares what the kids have to deal with? But once it got to our bedroom, we're like, man, I can't stand this thing over a garage where it's freezing during the wintertime, or it's hotter than anything during the summertime. You just can't get it insulated properly. They put spray and foam, and that they did the whole thing spray and foam, the roof and the floors and the boards and the everything. And it looked like Christmas upside down in that place. It was absolutely crazy to look at, but it has been perfect. Like, the temperature just stays spot on exactly where it needs to be. It's like you want to just live in that area.
The difference between spray foam and regular insulation, the R values are the same. The difference between the two is air infiltration. It stops air movement. The regular insulation is kind of like cotton candy.
Yeah.
If you hold it up in front of you and blow, you could literally blow through it. So the spray foam is more like a styrofoam cooler. If you hold it up in front of you and blow, it stops the air.
Right.
So 90 degrees outside, when the wind blows, now it's 90 degrees inside.
Yeah.
That insulation did nothing to stop that air movement, whereas the spray foam did.
Yeah.
And, even in a house that's sitting perfectly still, you have air movement just because heat rises. When heat rises, it goes out. Something has to replace it, so you get that draft. And it's just simple thermodynamics that we learned in elementary school, but most of us kind of can't see the forest for the trees.
Yeah, forget about all that stuff.
Right.
So,
right.
Steve, tell us your motivation to getting into solar.
I guess necessity being the mother of invention. I found myself looking for something to do about 3 or 4 years ago. My background is in engineering as an undergrad, and then later on finance. Went and got an MBA and worked in investment banking, and then later commercial real estate through the early part of through 2008 or so, and obviously things started going pretty bad in commercial real estate about that time. So found myself looking for something new and kind of reinventing myself, and always have had a sort of green angle bend to me, I guess. Actually, among other things, I'd renovated my house in a green way myself. I'd spray and insulation and gutted my house and did all the spray and foam and those things that Tim was describing, but enjoyed that, but then was looking within that niche for what really made sense to me. Obviously, having a little bit of a financial acumen, I was, you know, and coming from a corporate world, kind of doing, you know, did the analysis and really decided that solar photovoltaics made a very attractive investment, something that was had some real merit to it. So started going down that path, and with the help of a partner I found, you know, have really been able to turn it into, you know, a nice little business.
You know, it's interesting, and having Bob on the show before and actually looking at the rainwater collection and actually talking to him from a business standpoint, all of these things make so much sense. And I think people, if they had the opportunity and it made financial sense to do it, you'd imagine that they'd drift towards this because of all the concerns about energy and waste and oil and everything else. And you get solar and you get water collection and you get saving energy and you get all these things. Why isn't this area of business exploding right now?
Well, I think we focus, and I think it's true for the rest of for the other guys, is that our marketing is focused on information and education. It's like identifying what the benefits are and then showing the, you know, the real results to people. And the more we can do that, we're a fledgling industry, all three of us, is that the more we can do that, the more it will, you know, take off and be understood. What we all do is alternative water supply, alternative ways of conserving energy or supplying energy. It's a matter of getting that word out.
So let's talk to each of you guys. Give me your, you know, 1 minute spiel on why your particular area, if somebody's coming to you and saying, look, I'm interested in water or conserving energy or providing energy, what argument can you make to those people that this is something that you should not wait on, this is something that you should be doing now?
Well, I can speak to solar, of course. You know, we position this as an investment, first and foremost. You know, the green aspects of it are, you know, the energy independence aspects of it are appealing to a lot of people. We try to stay out of people's political or social viewpoints as much as possible. At the end of the day, you're going to spend X and you're going to get Y back. And if this return on investment makes sense to you, then solar is a very reliable energy source. It is a very reliable investment from the standpoint of, you know, when you look at the risk return profile of a solar project, it is, you know, the return of an equity investment with the risk of a bond investment. So it is essentially a, you know, a high return, low risk proposition. That's what we lead with. That's what we stick with. The extra benefits are, you know, just a bonus for most customers.
Well, what are some of the benefits of doing solar here in Georgia? I mean, clearly we get a good amount of sun, but are there any other major benefits or downsides to having solar here in Georgia?
There's nothing specific about Georgia that is bad per se about it. You know, at the end of the day, there's a number of regulations and then conversely incentives that are sort of drive the equation, right? You know, in order to get the return on investment that you need to have, you know, a willing participant utility that to either sell the power to, or you need to be willing to use the power yourself. Generally speaking, we sell it to the utility because the utility will pay a little bit more for it. And then you need to have fit a investment profile that can utilize the incentives that are available, be it, you know, tax incentives, depreciation type incentives. So there's nothing about Georgia. I mean, Georgia gets more sun than other states that are more popular. I mean, the biggest states for solar in the United States are California, of course,
yeah.
And out west, several states, you know, New Mexico, Arizona, but also the Northeast. New Jersey is the second largest state for it.
Really?
Yeah, and it has
New Jersey?
Yeah, yeah, and it has to do with the basically their. I think it's a lot harder to build new power plants in New Jersey to keep up with, yeah, with demand. You know, obviously it's a dense state and there's a lot of regulation, but Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, New York are also states that have done a lot of solar investment. Germany is the largest nation. Germany gets about half the sun we do in Georgia. So,
wow.
So we've got plenty of sun resource here, and the cost of solar is certainly becoming much more reasonable, to the extent that, you know, in 3 to 5 years, we will not need any incentives if we keep on this trend that we're on. So that's the goal of the incentive systems. I mean, we've talked a little before this, and I'm happy to address these issues. You know, people look at incentives as if they are a negative. They're in place to build the industry, and that's what they're doing. They're doing a good job. 5 years ago, 3 years ago when we started as a business, these systems were literally 50 to 60% more expensive. And as a result, we are in turn passing those savings on to our customers. So their return on investment is getting better, but at the same time, the incentives are getting lower as well. And the goal, of course, is in 5 years is to phase out those incentives so that we can earn the same return without any government assistance whatsoever. Which the other big source of power won't be able to say. Yeah. So coal and nuclear and all these other guys are heavily subsidized, whether we realize it or not.
Okay. Bob, talk to us about rainwater collection and what why that's something that more people should be thinking about now.
Well, yeah, certainly the financial return is always something that is a benefit. Here, and it's very, compared to energy, it's very, very local. If you look at, say, Metro Atlanta, City of Atlanta, the paybacks or the financial returns is something we talk about a lot.
Yeah.
As you move out, in a radius around Metro Atlanta, it changes because water rates change. Water, like energy, is heavily subsidized. We pay basically the costs, and what water is priced at is a matter of debate. But nevertheless, even in today's situation, there are excellent financial returns. But the reason that people want to do it is the other benefits, reducing erosion, improving water quality, stormwater runoff, especially here in Atlanta area or Georgia, where we have clay, Georgia clay.
Yeah.
Water runs off. And it goes into the water system, creates dirty water, runs downstream, runs into the ocean, and becomes salt water. So we're reducing our fresh water supply. That's the environmental side of things. But on the financial side of things, there are very, very strong paybacks, especially on the commercial side in the city of Atlanta and other parts of the U.S. and the world. For example, if you look at, say, you look at businesses with high water use and big roofs, and those are the ones that will have the best financial returns. Look at the restaurant industry, hotel industry. Businesses like that have very, very strong financial returns.
You and Steve must love big roofs. You guys must just like drive around Atlanta and look at the size of that roof. They're
I love collecting water off solar panels. That's the best surface for collecting rainwater.
You guys
it really
like
goes hand in hand.
Match made in heaven right
so
there.
So you fly out of the airport and it's you can see the potential.
Yeah, you're like,
right there.
You get a
of course.
Little,
yeah, we go hand in hand. We're the rain and shine guys.
Yeah.
That's right. You guys join up and you guys will be happy all year round.
We've actually tried some marketing that way.
All right. talk to us a little bit, Tim, about kind of the energy saving side of, and it's really residential is really your main focus, I would imagine.
Mostly residential, yeah, and I'd say probably most of our business is the geothermal installations. The geothermal, like Steve mentioned, the incentives, the rebates definitely help. We kind of look at it as a way of inoculating yourself against rising energy cost. If fuel cost 25 cents a gallon, we probably wouldn't have anybody driving a Prius in Atlanta.
Right.
However, fuel jumps up to $4 a gallon. Now it's the best-selling car in the market. Same thing kind of goes with our energy in Georgia. We have fairly low energy in Georgia due to a lot of the ways we produce the power, hydroelectric, coal, nuclear. But those methods are, you know, somewhat harmful to the environment. And at some point, we're going to have to pay the dues, whether it's taxes or regulation. At some point, you know, in my opinion, the power's got nowhere to go but up.
Mm-hmm.
So if you go ahead and start now, you know, inoculate yourself from high energy bills, you can, you know, who cares what's going on the TV news? You know, what, you know, what are they talking about? Energy bills, I don't care because I don't have one.
Yeah.
So.
Or you're not as exposed to the increases in those prices.
That's right. That's right.
So the geothermal is the main business side that you work with? Is that the main installation that you're doing right now?
That's probably 75 to 80% of our business, yeah.
Okay. And then you do a little bit of the rainwater stuff, and you do the insulation and mm-hmm. a number of other things.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to go in and just kind of protect that whole house from energy costs.
That's right. You know, if a customer, if we're in a project and a customer, usually they start with the geothermal. Most of the time it can turn into also spray foaming the house, which reduces the size of the geothermal system, which reduces the cost of the geothermal system, which offsets the cost of the spray foam.
Right.
So it's a win-win situation. You know, if they want to keep going forward, you know, we can do a geothermal de-superheater, which will actually produce free hot water off of the geothermal system. So it's a really neat concept, and a lot of it can snowball. Some customers want all the bells and whistles. They also want the solar. They also want solar water heating. They also want
you know,
all these different aspects. So it can snowball into a really green project. And you know, I've seen some 12,000 square foot homes in Atlanta, Georgia, with $200 a month power bills.
Wow,
which is very good
for a house of that size. And then no water heating because the roof is so big, or no water bills because the roof is so big that you can collect all the rainwater you need.
That particular house.
And then the solar, and then you're done.
Well, that particular house actually did collect all of its rainwater, and that went through a 6-stage filtration process, and that's the drinking water for the house.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, progressive. All right, I got to go back to this geothermal thing because I know some of our listeners are asking this question because it's in my brain. I don't know. Geothermal to me sounds like it's got to be coming from the core of the earth or something. So how does this work?
Okay. Geothermal system is what they call a water source heat pump. Real quick analogy. If you take two frying pans, put them on the stove, take them, heat them both up, glowing red hot, take one off of the stove, wave it around in the air, wait for it to cool off. Now take the other glowing red hot frying pan and stick it in a sink of water. Which one cooled off faster?
I think the water.
Right. Water removes heat faster than air. Simple elementary science.
Yeah, I got that.
So
I'm with you.
So it's a water source heat pump. Where you have a regular heat pump that sits outside, has a coil that gets hot, and a fan is trying to dissipate heat to the atmosphere. Now, let's take that coil, let's bring it inside, and let's circulate water past it. Now, we're disposing of heat to the water.
Right.
That water, let's just say it enters that coil at 70 degrees. It might leave the coil at 76 degrees. Now, how do we cool that water back off to 70 degrees for free? Circulate it through the earth. So, depending on the size of the system, we may need 1,000 linear feet of pipe. We may need 2,000 linear feet of pipe.
Mm-hmm.
And we just bury that pipe in the earth. We can go horizontally. We can drop it to the bottom of a pond. Or we can drill holes straight down and go straight down into the earth. So doing that, we actually, the earth conditions that water back, and it will never send us a bill to do so.
Hmm.
The same thing happens in reverse in the wintertime. The water might enter that coil at, let's say, 60 degrees. It might leave the coil at 54. Circulate through the earth, comes back at 60 degrees. What it does is it takes that 6 degrees of heat, concentrates it with that AC compressor, and gives you a 120-degree coil.
Mm, okay.
So that's how you get these you know, I get a lot of questions at home shows. People saying, "Well, it's the Earth's 60 degrees. I don't want to heat my house with 60 degree water."
Right.
You're not. You're actually taking a portion of that heat, compressing it, concentrating it, and actually bringing it into the house.
All right.
Works very well.
Very cool. Very cool. So let's talk a little bit about how if you guys were pulling the strings on the money or the puppets that had the money anyway, how do you provide, and you Steve talked about this a little bit, how do you provide incentives, financial incentives? If you're the government, how do you provide financial incentives for people to start purchasing these types of products more because they are energy, because they're natural resources, or they're saving energy, but then you don't get addicted to it? Like coal or oil or some of these other places where we continue to give them subsidies because we started giving them subsidies, you know, 100 years ago. How do you do it, and why would you do it in the beginning stages, and then when would you get rid of it?
Well, it sounds like, at least with solar, the way Steve described it, is it is built in to be phased out. From the water supply point of view, I just wish we had some sort of incentives to jumpstart our industry to help us, you know, as a society to think more long-term. We tend to think a little bit short-term.
Right.
That's the way we are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so if we could collectively do that, I would love to have that in terms of, you know, creating small water supplies versus big reservoirs. So that's kind of my two cents on that. Not so much how do we phase them out, but how do we, you know, use that in this particular industry.
Have you ever thought about how, if you went to a congressman and said, "I'd like to make this proposal to you," have you ever thought of something like that?
Well, yeah, I think about, you know, here in Georgia, we are thinking about building reservoirs. It's going to cost money. And how much is that going to cost? And how is it going to be paid for? And how long will it take? We know that in other places, rainwater has become an integral part of water supply and has been done much faster than what you could do in terms of building new reservoirs. And it's been financed privately rather than you know, publicly.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the arguments I would use, is that it would be lower cost publicly, and it could be done faster, and it can be done in a way that's financially beneficial to a property owner and not being done in a way that's, you know, sort of government-run, been more privately financed.
So Lake Lanier, which has obviously got to be a something on well, it's not probably on top of everybody's mind, but it's definitely in the back of their mind going, you know, what's going on with this whole water wars thing in Alabama and Georgia and Florida, and how might that blow up in our face, and what could we do to prevent it?
Well, one of the ways we're positioning rainwater is, or rainwater collection as a water supply and stormwater runoff mechanism, is that it can be used as something to be done in the meantime as we develop new water supplies. Rather than saying this is an either-or situation, we can do rainwater collection over the next, say, 10 years, whereas building new reservoirs, watersheds, interbasin transfers, you're talking through the regulatory hurdles 10, 20, maybe even longer to come online. And if we want Metro Atlanta's growth to be whatever we want it to be, to meet that the water demands that there are, mm-hmm. we need something in the meantime, mm-hmm. and that's where we position rainwater collection, which are basically small reservoirs that are privately owned.
So it's a lot faster kind of getting those things up and running versus a whole new reservoir.
That's been the track record in other places.
Okay. Tim, Steve, any other comments on that?
On a similar note, solar is something that's quickly implementable, if that's a word, and you know, I guess rapidly deployable. Maybe that's the right word. But as an example, you know, in Germany, in literally a 6-month period, they were able to install about 2 gigawatts of solar capacity.
I don't know what that means.
Well, that's about the equivalent of the nuclear power plant that we've been trying to build up in North Georgia, which is on a 10-year track to be built.
Wow.
At a cost of, you know, billions of dollars. So a lot of that money could be, solar is what you call distributed generation,
yep.
Much like rainwater collection, where you're collecting it in your house and you're using it at your house. When you generate solar power, you then use it at your house. Two-thirds of the power that is generated at a distant power plant, 100 miles from the city, is lost in transmission.
Right.
So
yep.
That's one of the, of course, the benefits of distributed generation. So there are a lot of benefits technically to the system of having solar in the mix. So there's no question that there is a place for solar. We're not anywhere near the point where we're going to replace our base load of power. So Georgia Power will continue to have a role in all of our lives, in terms of meeting that base load. But, you know, what we're looking to do is supplement it and create a solution that is, you know, long term. You know, these are systems that last 25, 30 years with little or no maintenance. So it's really a simple solution to meeting our energy needs. I think we were talking specifically about what we can do incentive wise to sort of phase these things in, build adoption, and then maybe phase them out over time. There are a lot of creative ways. One of the great things about the solar industry is it is very much within region to region, and even within the state, it's market to market as far as how the economics work out. But we can look at, you know, what's been successful in California and what's worked in New Jersey and what's not worked in certain places as an example of what incentives will work and drive the behavior we want. So it's as simple as looking around and seeing what behavior you want to happen. My personal opinion is to have something like a renewable portfolio standard, which basically means the state would mandate a certain amount of renewable energy supplied by the utilities, and the utilities can do that. So it's just, you know, one of the things you probably heard, Barack Obama or others say is, 20% by 2020. Mm-hmm. You know, these are referring to this renewable portfolio standard. They're basically saying by 2020, we're going to have 20% renewables, and California has set a ridiculous standard of like 50%, by 2030 or something like that. Other states obviously are lower, and Georgia, if we did this, would be much lower than that, I'm sure. But once you establish this, you're basically mandating that the utilities buy so much solar power, and they can either go out and install it themselves, mm-hmm. or they can let the private market do it themselves by setting a price for the power. And I don't mean ridiculous prices. I mean reasonable prices, that are in line with, the price of power at peak times. And then let the market figure out how to get these things installed. So that's what's worked in New Jersey. That's what's worked in a lot of states. And what you can do is basically set a price and then ratchet it down over time so that in 5 years the price is more on par with market rates for electricity.
So what do you see as a tipping point for solar to be a much larger part of energy? I mean, is it going to be the cost of insulation or installation of solar panels on residential? So like you said, if I've got solar panels on my house, the energy is going from the solar panel right to the house. There's no energy loss. It's right there. Or is it going to be something to the degree where these power companies are paying, like you said, so much more money for something where you've got these farms or something that are creating the power and then getting it to them?
And my personal opinion is that the commercial scale projects will lead, just because the economics are going to always be better on a larger scale project. It's just a matter of I think you need both. When you look at some of these more mature markets, they do have incentives that work for residences, and they have incentives that work for commercial customers. We need to basically be able to historically for us as a company, we've focused on markets where we can return for our customer something in excess of 12% IRR. So when we can put that kind of incentive, an investment package together, which is means we can secure all the incentives and tie up basically in a pretty little bow,
mm-hmm.
an investment that's fairly risk-free and give our customer 12% return, we can sell that. We know if we can, once we have that, we can go into that market. And
I think I got some buyers for something.
Okay,
like that.
Yeah. And absolutely. I mean, it makes a lot of sense when you compare it to investment alternatives.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's a relatively easy sale when we find the right customer in those markets. But so it's just a matter on the commercial side of getting things to align such that we can do large scale projects. There's no shortage of money, as you know, as probably a lot of your listeners know. I mean, people have money; they're looking to invest in the right place. And so, if we can create the right environment here in Georgia, now that's includes the regulatory environment, which we really haven't gotten into much here.
We won't.
But I mean, in short, Georgia Power does not really, and the state really doesn't have a provision that allows the sale of third-party power right now. So, which is to say, if you are a large building owner and you didn't want to, say, invest in the power and use it yourself, you, unlike a lot of states, you could not lease your roof to someone like, you know, Solar Company of America,
right?
To just pick a name out of the air, and have them own the system and sell the power to you, you know, or to somebody else for that matter. So
it has to go back to Georgia Power.
You either can sell it to Georgia Power or you can sell it to the building owner, but you can't sell it to a third party.
Gotcha.
And it's that sort of option that makes the market that much more open, right? It just basically allows for more creative investment options, and then and basically opens it up to, you know, larger investors and larger pools of money who specialize in solar and can do it at a lower rate.
That's the PPA.
That's the PPA the that you hear about. The power purchase agreement is not is something that the sort of the solar community is working on right now with the state, and that will allow you know, larger scale projects to be done more easily. But again, there's a number of ways around these things. There's other ways to be creative with it. That's kind of where we're at right now, is getting very creative with customers. And so, you know, it'd be, if you really wanted to scale it, you have to take some of the creativity out and keep it a little simpler. So,
how many states allow PPAs, if I may ask a question?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, about 26 states. So, and some of them are voluntary. Anyway, I don't know all the ins and outs of it, because it gets pretty technical, as you can imagine. There's a lot of legalese involved with these things, and there's a lot of wrangling that's going on with the utility commission and the powers that be. So,
Tim, on kind of same question, are there any incentives around your business that would be helpful, or that you would like to put a bug in the ear of somebody that might be listening?
Sure. Geothermal has a lot of the same incentives that solar has. 30% renewable energy tax credit from the federal government. Now, on the state tax credit level, it's a $2,000 rebate, whereas solar is 35%. So it's a much bigger state tax credit. Mm-hmm. You had asked, what could be done to kind of motivate this and get it going. The tax credits certainly help, but I'm all for deregulation, keeping the government out of things. But one of the few good things that we have done is we've created this energy code, and we've bumped up the standard over the past few years of these SEER ratings that I explained about, minimum requirements. A few years back we were 10 SEER, then 12 SEER, now we're 13 SEER. However, in my opinion, these minimum SEER ratings really have not kept pace with the technology. An energy code is regulation. But code is also done for the right reasons. It's there to protect the public. It's there to protect the environment. Many states now have an energy code, which is standards that are in addition to the code. I would personally like to see the energy code made a little more stringent. I'm not saying let's increase our power bills, But I would like to see our energy produced in a better, cleaner manner. Solar farms, for example. It's actually written that a coal power plant produces more nuclear waste than a properly functioning nuclear power plant.
Really?
Yeah. You know, the slogan, you know, clean coal, if you've heard that slogan, that was actually a marketing firm was hired to come up with that slogan and clean up the image of coal. It's the same marketing firm that did the "What happens in Vegas stays in Vegas." You know, they're trying to clean up the image, but clean coal is really like.
I'm not sure that cleans up the Vegas image. I think that actually helps to support.
Well, I think they're trying to push it though. But yeah, saying clean coal is like clean dirt. You know, when they excavate coal, there's other things in there with it: uranium, plutonium. You know, you put that in an incinerator, that goes in the air. What's being rained on us on a daily basis? So, if we had cleaner forms of energy, needless to say, they would cost more money. But we're not damaging the planet in the process. If it costs us more money, we're going to be a little more motivated to save energy. I grew up doing a lot of camping as a kid. You know, when you camp, you learn about conservation. You walk into that 2-day or 3-day camp out with 2 propane tanks, some lanterns, some batteries. You know, you don't just turn on all the lanterns and leave them running all night long. You don't use up all your water. You don't take a 15-minute shower. You have a 5-gallon bag, you know, that you hang on a tree, and that's your shower water
right.
for the next 2 days. So yeah. You really learn how to conserve. And, you know, going back to kind of Grog the caveman days, you know, he didn't walk into his cave and turn on the lights and let them stay on all night. You know, he conserved energy, and we kind of have to get back to that. Let's not waste what we've got. Yes, we have some great luxuries, but a lot of what we're doing is very wasteful. Kind of going back to Vegas. Vegas is kind of the epitome of wastefulness. You know, they waste
coal
food.
In Vegas. There's their connection. Yeah, I guess that's it.
Yeah.
You know, and just and along those similar lines. I mean, we try to stay away from the over green aspects of these things. I mean, the reality is, if, whether you believe in global warming, whether you believe in the you know conservation and the importance of those things, which I happen to be, you know, firmly believe in, the reality is it's getting nearly impossible to build coal plants, you know, coal power plants. And producing power from coal and nuclear have obvious negative side effects. You know, you can sugarcoat it all you want. You can dress it up all you want. Those are the realities. There are real costs associated with those things, which are not included in our energy mix. They're being subsidized, propped up, or ignored in the equation. So, I mean, the reality is these things are changing. It's an exciting time to be in this field for the simple reason that it is very dynamic. There are things going on. There are technologies emerging. There are viewpoints that are being expressed that are different, and people are starting to understand that there are alternatives, and a lot of them make sense. And they don't just make economic sense. They make environmental sense, and they improve our quality of life and you know, make us feel better about how we operate. So, I mean, you know, on the jobs front, you know, I love the fact that when I install solar, I am taking a guy out of a coal plant. You know, I mean, I think that's the goal, is to get guys out of digging holes and going down underground and taking black rocks and throwing them in a fire and then going back and doing it again over and over for his entire life. I mean, with all due respect to the people in the coal mining regions of the country, that's not the goal for my kids. That's not what I want for my future, is to put people in a hole. We want them, I mean, this, I can get that power from the sun for little or no environmental impact, and once it's installed, it's going to run for 30 years. So why wouldn't I do that? I mean, everything else being equal, why wouldn't I do that?
So that actually segues into my last question, which is, kind of vision, 10 years down the road, what do you see changing? What do you see things looking like, or what would you like to see things looking like 5 to 10 years from now in your area? Bob, let's start with you.
We hear a lot about the idea that water is the next oil, meaning that water is going to be as, you know, considered in people's mind as important as energy. We hear a lot of buzz about energy. We talk a lot more about energy than water, but it's changing. And I think 5 to 10 years from now, you'll see that, and we'll start feeling and identifying and really internalizing the fact that water is a resource we need to manage locally.
Okay. And Tim?
I foresee in 5 to 10 years a lot more homes being built that may be, you know, net zero energy homes. The trend is happening in California. There are builders that have figured out a set plan or method, and you know, it's no one fix. It's a collection of all these technologies that we've talked about today, put together to make you know, a zero energy home. I don't foresee zero energy homes being the standard, but I do see a lot more of them happening. And I definitely see that a lot of consumer-driven, energy-efficient technologies put in homes through the education that we're doing today.
All right. Good. Steve?
You know, I would say I think the where we're at now and the important thing that we need to be working towards on a sort of 5 to 10 year basis is just, you know, bridging this next gap. You know, the next 5 years are very important for our industry. As I come back to again is, you know, we're trying to get to a point where we don't need subsidies. So we need to, you know, we don't need the incentives at the same scale that we had when we started, but we still need them, and we need them to, again, bridge this gap to get to a point where, you know, solar becomes a ready mix, a ready part of a building plan and solution. You know, I would envision a day in the not so distant future where anyone putting up a large warehouse or a home builder is automatically including solar and some of these technologies in their projects because they make sense, because they wouldn't be able to sell them without them. Yep. You know, I mean, I think that's, you know, the lead standard for commercial buildings is becoming more and more acceptable. And I would say that you can't have a Class A building right now unless you are at least addressing some of these energy efficiency issues. I would say the same thing for a high-end home. I would say if in the near future, if you are not on par with the standards of Earthcraft, which you would probably not be considered a luxury home, just from the comfort and the quality of living in the building, in addition to the energy bills. You know, I've lived in a home that was built in 1910, and it operates like a house that's brand new, because I went through a lot of the steps that Tim's been talking about. So, you know, and it's not even about conserving; it's about conserving my money, and making my home more efficient. So,
right.
So I think 5 years, that's where I think we're going to be, is where these things become, we're past the bait stage, and we're to the point of how do we get them in cheaper, how do we get them in more, how do we make them part of the standard.
It seems like our respective industries, the analogy I like to make is air conditioning. You know, in the 50s, it was, people used air conditioning, but not very much. But now you have to have it, especially
this
here.
This is part of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, typically I ask a pearl of wisdom at the end, and you guys have given so many throughout the morning. Is there anything else that you want to end with that might be something you'd like to leave the listeners with?
I like the little three-part slogan, save energy, save money, save the planet.
All right, Tim. Anything else? Bob? Steve?
Yeah, I don't know that I have any pearls.
You got nothing.
I got nothing.
Nothing in like it.
He let it all hang out.
He gave it to us all. He's done.
Yeah.
He's done. Empty. Tank is empty. All right. Well, I appreciate you guys coming by today. We really appreciate your time and coming up. And Tim, the two-hour drive up from Noonan, we really appreciate that for sure. With allergy season in the mix, windows were all open and everything. You're breathing that good fresh air. And
not this morning.
He's waiting for another rainstorm.
Yeah, that's right. We're all waiting for a little rain, except for Steve. I do appreciate the time from our listeners. We hope you enjoyed the show. And until next week, be safe.
John Baker is a certified financial planner with a Master's of Science in Personal Financial Planning. Certified Financial Planner Board of Standards, Inc. owns the certification mark CFP, Certified Financial Planner, TM and CFP, and in the U.S., which it awards to individuals who successfully complete the CFP Board's initial and ongoing certification requirements. John Baker offers financial planning and securities through Woodbury Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor and broker-dealer, member FINRA SIPC, located at 1050 Crown Point Parkway, Suite 1675, Atlanta, Georgia, 30338. This program is for information purposes only and should not be considered a solicitation of or offer to buy or offer to sell securities or investment advisory services. Information in this program regarding market or other financial information is obtained from sources which are believed to be reliable. We do not warrant or guarantee the timeliness or accuracy of this information. When considering any registered security products, seek a prospectus carefully before you invest. Make sure you consult your financial professional regarding any specific situation.